So I'm making a network of digital podcasts that we will monetize, that is going to meet. Sorry.
That guy, bumbling through a sales pitch, is Alex Blumberg. He's actually a great reporter. You might recognize his voice from This American Life and NPR's Planet Money. His recent venture is a podcast called Startup. Funny enough, it's about a podcasting company he's trying to build. In this scene, he's talking with billionaire Chris Sacca, and it's not going well.
So it'll take $1.5 million, I think.
Take out the I think.
Yeah. It'll take $1.5 million. I'm looking for $1.5 million to $2 million in seed stage funding.
No. Yeah. You're looking for a very specific amount of money.
I'm looking for...
This goes on for a long time. Finally, the billionaire financier helps Alex out. Actually, he does his job for him. He tells his story.
We're putting together $1.5 million. That's going to buy us 3-4 guys who are going to launch these 3 podcasts in the next 12 months. We think very easily we could get to 300,000-400,000 net subscribers across the whole thing. With CPMs where they are in this market right now, I know on advertising alone we could get to break even, but as we do more of this integration, we get people buying some of this product, doing some of these integrated episodes, I know that we're going to have on our hands here something that will ultimately scale to be a network of 12, 15 podcasts. The audience is there. They want it. Nobody else can do it like we can. Are you in?
That was amazing.
That's your story, right?
That is great.
Just months later, Gimlet Media became a reality with 2 shows in their network, including Startup. But as the media landscape shifts and podcasts gain in popularity, can this story have a happy ending? What does it take to make a podcast work? I'm Brian Ellison, and today on Central Standard, we welcome back the Audiophiles, our resident and guest denizens of American podcasting. We'll talk today about sustainability and even profit in the online audio world. We're going to talk first with Matt Staub, who is the host of a local podcast, Is There There There? Good morning. Welcome to you, Matt.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks.
And KCUR's Brianna O'Higgins. She's the digital content editor here at KCUR.
Good morning, Brian.
Good to have you on the air, Brianna. In a moment, we're going to listen to a little bit of a clip from one of the podcasts that is grown in popularity over the past 8 months, Startup, which is itself the story of podcasts, of a company that seeks to build podcasts. We're going to talk today about the business of podcasting. How is it that a small program becomes something that is carried nationwide, has a wide listening audience, and actually becomes sustainable as a business? Let's talk a little bit about Startup before we hear from it. Brianna O'Higgins, what is Startup?
So Startup is a podcast. It is hosted by Alex Blumberg, who many people know from This American Life, from Planet Money. He's an alum of both those programs. He actually left producing on those shows to start up Gimlet Media, which is the company that he's actually starting up. Startup is one of the podcasts that they offer. The other is called Reply All. I'm pretty sure those are the only two they have. And Startup specifically is just sort of the day-to-day of starting a startup business.
Right. And Startup itself is about podcasts, but it's also about business, right, Matt?
Yeah. And it's one of the great things about the podcast medium is it's so intimate and vulnerable that you never get an idea of what the neuroses of people starting businesses are. But you get to hear all the uncertainty and all the challenges and all the kind of behind the curtains stuff that you would never get to see. So it's very much about how do we monetize this? What's our future? Are we doing the right thing? All of that.
Well, we're going to listen to a little bit of the most recent episode of Startup. In this scene, Alex Blumberg, who's the host and the founder, is sitting on his couch with his wife. They're watching the Grammys, although the Grammys are on mute while they're having this conversation. They're talking about what this year, this incredible year of taking a business from zero to fully operational, has been like. Let's listen.
That's Prince.
That's Prince.
God, that man does not age.
Yeah.
How you feel about the whole project so far?
It's been really exciting to see you do it, you know, and like to see you go from nothing, just having an idea and being frustrated that no one else was doing it. Like, for a really long time, like, I felt like you were frustrated that no one else had done this.
Right.
And it's been really, yeah, exciting to see you do it. But, like, having said that, do I, like, wish our lives were the way they were before you started the company? Yes.
Really?
Well, not really. Like, I feel like this is what you should be doing. So
right.
It's not like I want you to be not doing this thing that I think you should be doing. But just, like, the day-to-day life that we used to have, like, was easier, yeah, for me.
How is it easier?
You just had a job, you know? Look at Taylor Swift. You were just mentally, like, you're just really preoccupied, you know? And I was used to you being that way when you were working on a big story or big project for, like, a couple of months at a time or something. But you're just, this is it. Like, this is just an endless big project.
Do you think our marriage will survive? Longer pause than I was expecting.
Do I think our marriage will survive? Well, I feel like we have
much longer. Really, it's gone to alarmingly longer than I was expecting.
Yes, I think our marriage will survive.
That was Alex Blumberg and his wife talking about not just the future of their marriage, but the future of Gimlet Media, the company that he, along with his partner Matt Lieber, started up just this year and is now producing podcasts. Matt Staub, you produce a local podcast. Just so none of our listeners are left behind here, remind us what a podcast is exactly.
So a podcast is basically just a radio show, but the difference is the distribution medium, and that is that you can download it online. It's an audio file that you can either subscribe to or go and manually download off of the web and listen to on any device.
And what does it take to produce a podcast? Is it just a good idea and a decent microphone, or is there a little more to it than that?
Well, it really depends. I think the ilk of some of the great podcasts are out there have raised the expectation for production value a little bit among people that listen to podcasts, because there's some really amazing ones. But really, if you have great ideas and something interesting to say, it's as simple as the voice memo app on your iPhone if you want to just get some thoughts out into the world.
You're a regular listener to podcasts, Brianna. What makes a podcast something worth listening to, in a nutshell?
Creative content or interesting content is the base. I mean, that's the base of what we try to do here at KCUR too. And so at its core, it has to be interesting and creative in a way. I listen to some podcasts that are sort of in the original style, a back and forth sort of banter, low production. And then I listen to some that are highly produced, you know, public radio professionals or radio professionals. So it really does just come down to interesting content.
Well, and we heard Alex Blumberg and his wife there talking about no one having done this before, by which he seemed to mean putting together a company that brings lots of podcasts to life and enhances their creativity and brings them to a wide distribution. I'm not sure that's really true, though. Joining us now is someone who has been running a podcast company for a bunch of years already, Jesse Thorne. He's sometimes called America's radio sweetheart. He's the host of the public radio program Bullseye and the co-host or producer of many other podcasts, including the Judge John Hodgman podcast. He also owns Maximum Fun, which is just the kind of big deal company we're talking about today. Jesse Thorne, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, thank you for having me, and thanks to Alex Blumberg for inventing podcast networks.
Ah, I see. I hear sarcasm in your voice, Jesse Thorne.
You don't know how many tweets I got after the first time he said that on his show.
So you were, I mean, before you were running what appears to be a successful podcasting company already, you were actually a successful public radio guy. How did you end up in the wild, wild west of podcasting?
Well, successful public radio guy is sort of a relative term. I mean, you guys work in public radio. You know that it's not the most remunerative field I mean, here's the deal. Like, I started my show, which is now Bullseye, as The Sound of Young America when I was in college. And I sort of kept doing it after college. And a few years after college, podcasting got invented. And the literal math in my head was, would I, if I could get 100 people to listen to this podcast, would I do the extra 2 hours of work if I was going to have my show play for 100 people in an auditorium? And I decided yes. So I started podcasting right at the beginning of podcasting. And shortly after that, I was sort of discovered by a gentleman from Public Radio International. And they said, would you be interested in getting distribution on public radio? And I said, yes. And they sent me these revenue projections for my show. Mm-hmm. And the 5-year plan was to bring me up to about $25,000 a year in revenue.
If things went well.
If things went well, yeah. For my hour-long weekly show. And so I thought, huh, I guess that public radio isn't going to be how I support myself and my wife and family. So I became a professional podcaster that very day.
And so talk a little bit about that. We're talking today about the business of podcasting, and we'll certainly get to some of the content of podcasts, both that you produce and that others that our team here is listening to. But how does it work? How does Maximum Fun actually operate? What is the business you're in exactly?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, I run Maximum Fun the way that a public radio station runs, which is to say that some of our revenue comes from advertising, or as it's called on public radio, underwriting. Some of our revenue comes from merchandise and live events and so on and so forth. But the bulk of our revenue comes from sustaining donors, folks who donate, you know, $5 a month. And that is enough now to run a network of about 20 shows, some of which we are producing in-house and some of which are produced by their creators and owned by their creators, who function with us in a sort of partnership, where we help them do the administrative parts of making money from their show and raising money based on their show. And they are, you know, they're part of our network and help us fundraise at fundraising time.
So is it fair to describe what you're running as sort of a mini NPR?
Well, I mean, I'm also part of Maxi NPR with Bullseye. And I don't think that, I think that there are values that are coincidental and there are also differences. I mean, I was just looking at some of the demographics from our study, and I would say that having seen public radio's audience demographics, ours are roughly the reverse. Age-wise,
which is to say, you're younger.
A lot of times when they show you a demographics chart for public radio, it starts at 35, and I would say that at least half of our audience is under 35, maybe more. And you know, it sort of shares some of the values of public radio, but for a new group of people.
I wonder if that's because of the content, the kinds of programs that you produce, or is it something different than that? Is it the medium?
I think it's both. You know, we're finally getting to a point, and I think one of the reasons that you've heard so much about podcasts again in the last year or so, when they had been relatively quiet for about 10 years in the mass media, is that we're finally getting to a point where the technology to deliver podcasts is just starting to become dead simple enough that it's worth the hassle to figure out how to do it for an average person rather than for someone who's, you know, a potential enthusiast. Ultimately, people listen to audio in their car. You know, I'm sure the people that are listening right now, you know, folks are listening at their cubicle at work, or they're listening in their car, or they're listening in their kitchen while they're getting ready to make lunch. And those are places where previously it was relatively inconvenient to listen to a show. And now that everyone has a smartphone in their pocket, or at least a large portion of people have a smartphone in their pocket, it's getting easier and easier to listen to podcasts. And that has meant that, you know, you don't have to be a technology enthusiast anymore to enjoy audio that's delivered over the internet.
Matt Staub, how often do you listen to podcasts? How many hours of podcast listening do you do a week?
There are never enough hours. I was thinking there are very little time where I'm not have some sort of audio in my ears. So I would say probably 2 to 3 hours a day. Any idle time or transition, I walk to work. So I listen while I walk. Pretty much any time I can take a 10-minute chunk, I'll consume some podcast.
It sounds like kind of the way that a lot of people listen to music. You've replaced music listening in your life with podcast listening.
For the most part, yeah, that's true.
And Brianna O'Higgins, is that your experience as well?
I probably listen to about an hour a day, usually towards the end of the day. Often when I'm doing stuff, but sometimes I'll just sit and listen. That was an experience I did with Serial. Just sat and did nothing else but listen. So
trying to pick up a clue.
Right. So about 7 to 10 hours a week.
I wonder, Jesse Thorne, in your experience, are people listening to podcasts differently than they listen to public radio? Are you cultivating a different kind of listener, a different kind of attentiveness to the content?
I absolutely think so. I mean, public radio is certainly the part of the radio landscape which people listen to the most attentively. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. But the truth is that if you look at the studies of how people consume radio, people tend to consume radio in 5, 10, 15-minute chunks. You know, it's like the time that you, between when you get in the car and you get to the grocery store, or the time when you're passing from room to room, or the time when you're walking your dog or whatever. And podcasts are distinct from that because they are on demand, which means that you can listen to them whenever you want. And so, you know, one of the reasons that Serial was called Serial is because it was possible to present radio content or audio content serially. You know, that's, you could have a reasonable expectation that someone would listen to episode 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, then 5, then 6, and so on, which you just can't do on radio because it's, you know, people haven't listened to the radio that way since 1955.
Right.
And so the fact that you can put it down and pick it back up in the place where you left makes it a very different listening experience. You also have the fact that people are actively choosing what they're listening to rather than sort of passively accepting what they're listening to. You know, people choose the 6 radio presets in their car or the station that their clock radio is tuned to or the shower radio or whatever. And that is a certain amount of exercise of choice. You know, you're listening to the station that plays, you know, hot R&B rather than the station that's playing rancheras. But that's very different from choosing a particular show that you want to listen to week in and week out.
You've mentioned that you got into the podcasting business essentially because producing a single show and distributing it through a regular public radio outlet was not a successful business model, at least not for your life. I guess I'm curious about the ways that revenue is coming into to podcasts these days, including your company, but others too. You mentioned advertising, which you offhandedly said is the public radio calls underwriting. Are advertising and underwriting really the same thing? You are accepting advertisements essentially on the programs. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and they're doing something different with their ad sales than I think I'm accustomed to hearing on NPR.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are very specific legal requirements that public radio adheres to when it comes to underwriting. They're essentially supposed to be a funding credit, you know, a sort of thank you. And public radio over the past 15 years, frankly, has stretched that to its limit, its legal limit. But it still is a very specific and limited thing. We try at Maximum Fun, we try and maintain the spirit of that, if not exactly the specific legal form. But you'll find that if you listen to podcasts in general, there are all kinds of new forms of advertising and audio, or if not completely new, relatively different forms of advertising and audio that you'll hear. You know, if you tune into the Adam Carolla podcast, you might hear a 5-minute break where he talks about a sponsor's product. You know, certainly, like if you tune into Rush Limbaugh on AM radio, you'll hear him talk about Ruth's Chris Steakhouse for a minute too. It's not completely new, but it's a way for advertisers to take advantage of what is really a very close and intimate relationship with the person who they have chosen, who the listener has chosen to talk into their ears. And
they're really staking their reputation, their identity, as what's selling that product.
hit.
Exactly. Yeah. And you won't. What you won't hear is the kind of commercials that you'll hear on commercial radio, which is to say sort of pre-recorded things. It's about that relationship between the broadcaster and the audience.
I mean, I wonder from you, Brianna O'Higgins, you're a journalist. You work primarily with digital content here at KCUR. Do you see ethical questions that arise in how funders are credited and how podcasts seem to be doing that differently?
Well, I mean, there's definitely a difference between what we would call like a commercial podcast or non-public radio affiliated. And I know that there's been conversation going on, you know, just recently in the public radio world about should we interrupt programming for a sponsor? Does that, you know, affect the listening experience? Mm. And of course, yes, who reads that sponsorship? Who reads that advertisement, whatever you call it?
Right, because the newscaster doesn't do that, for example, on NPR, or the people who bring you news content don't do that. And yet on these podcasts, almost invariably, it's the host.
Right, and I have read that you know, people who want to sell this advertising, they are very interested in the hosts reading that content for, you know, because of what Jesse just said. You know, you have chosen to listen to this podcast. Those are the voices you're expecting to hear. Those are the people you trust in a certain sense, you want to hear from. So having them also endorse a product is very desirable to advertisers.
You know, Matt Staub, you have a different sort of investment that your company makes in producing this weekly podcast that you coordinate. It isn't a matter of soliciting advertising for it, but there's still a serious investment, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's mostly the time that's required for us to produce every week, and we want to produce a level of production value that we're proud of. But for us, it's like an alternative to buying advertising. For us, it's content marketing. So it's part of what we put out into the world to showcase our work and our thought process.
Well, we're going to take a little break here. And when we come back, we'll continue to talk a little bit about the business of podcasting. We'll also hear from all of our guests about what they're listening to these days. We want to hear from you as well. If there's a particular podcast you've been hearing, or if you have a question for our guests, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. It's the audio files on Central Standard. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Today, the audio files are here. Local podcast guy Matt Staub, KCUR's Brianna O'Higgins, and America's radio sweetheart and podcast impresario, Jesse Thorne. Jesse, so you're in the business of trying to make great podcasts. We talked a little bit before you joined us about what makes a podcast listenable. What do you think makes one great?
Well, I think there has to be a compelling reason to listen. You know, one of the things that's different about podcasting relative to broadcasting is that when you broadcast, you know, you are part of a landscape of what? 20, 30, 40 stations that people can choose among on their radio dial. And that allows a certain amount of specificity. When you're podcasting, you are one choice among tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of podcasts. And so you have to motivate people to listen much more deeply than you do on the radio. You know, on the radio, your main goal is often just to keep people from changing the channel. And on a podcast, you have to motivate people to tune in. And so it has to be something special. And it can be special to a relatively small number of people. I mean, I love to listen to a podcast called The Pub, which is produced by Current, the newspaper of public radio and television. It's about public media specifically. It's something that appeals to a group of, you know, I don't know, what, 5,000 people in the United States or 10,000 people in the United States. But it means a lot to me. To listen to and enjoy. And so, you know, it's something that has to be much, much more strongly motivated than your decision to turn on the radio and listen to whatever happens to be there.
I guess the question it raises is, you know, since we've been talking about sort of the business of podcasting, is financial success really a good measure of a podcast's greatness? I can imagine a really excellent podcast that, because it is so focused in nature, simply will never have anything you could call financial success.
You know, it's funny. Number one, I think that's absolutely true. You know, I think one of the nice things about the democratization of media on the internet is that people have an opportunity to express themselves, and if they can do it well, they can often reach an audience irrespective of how much money they have going in or how much money the operation generates. You know, if it's something that you believe in talking about, whether it's on a blog or you know, on social media or on a podcast, you can do it even if you're not making money, and you probably will do it even if you're not making money.
Well, right. Which, I mean, you're even the name of your company, Maximum Fun, suggests that maybe this is about people having fun as much as making a living.
Well, I think for most of our hosts, and you know, the circumstances for our hosts vary wildly, but for most of our hosts, this is a complementary career. All of our hosts are making money and significant amounts of money, but I don't think almost any of them. I don't think that for almost any of them, this is their sole occupation. It is for me and a few people that work in the office, but mostly this is a part of a broader career in media and entertainment.
So the last time we did this Audiophiles broadcast, we were in the throes of Serial, which had gripped the nation with its popularity and people sitting on the edge of their seats. But since then, there have been even new developments in the world of podcasting, some long-term podcasts, but also some new ones. Matt Staub, what's a podcast that you've been listening to lately?
So Invisibilia is an interesting one that I think all of us talked about, and it's a new show from a really interesting pedigree of producers, one from This American Life and one from the Radiolab, which we talked about last time. Two amazing shows from NPR. And Invisibilia is basically designed to look at the invisible forces that drive us, the things that unconsciously bias us or drive our behavior. So it's a really interesting show.
And Brianna, this was on your list of shows that you're listening to as well. What do you like about Invisibilia?
Well, I've long been a Elise Spiegel fan. So from just her bits on Morning Edition, which is often where NPR would play her stories. So I was super excited before I even heard anything, just because I knew that I was really into her stories, which often have to do with the social sciences, social science research, how people behave. So I was super excited before it even came out. And I think they've sort of delivered. It's Elise Spiegel plus another producer named Lulu Miller, who I wasn't familiar with, at least by name.
Well, plus when they're on the air, you can't tell them apart.
Which they like to remind us
yes.
over and over again. But yeah, just they've really delivered, and in the fashion of Elise Spiegel that I've liked for probably a decade now. Just great content.
We're going to listen to a little bit of one of the recent episodes. This is Invisibilia.
From NPR News, this is Invisibilia. And today we're going to start with a question that was recently asked of the customers of the Rise coffee shop in Midtown Manhattan. Lulu, what's the question?
It's a very hard-hitting question.
It is.
Do you like puppies or kittens?
Puppies are cute. Doesn't everybody like puppies?
Kittens. I like kittens. I think they're cuter.
Oh, for sure, puppies.
Puppies. The dog is always happy to see you. It's just, it wags its tail. Cats, man, they won't. They, come here. Nothing.
Now, the reason these people are talking about this is because up at the register at this place, Rise, they always put out two tip jars. Two big glass jars with little chalkboards in front. And every day they write on the little chalkboards two different categories to choose from. So one day it might be cassette tape versus vinyl.
Another day it might be Samsung versus Apple.
Or
kittens versus puppies!
Puppies all the way.
I'm a kitten person.
I am definitely a cat person.
For sure, puppies. I hate cats. There's been one cat that's like more of a dog than a cat. I enjoyed that cat.
Rise started doing this about 2 years ago. And Danielle Cloutier, one of the baristas there, said that it completely changed the amount of tips people were giving.
Oh, definitely. It's definitely getting us more tips.
Inadvertently, they seemed to have stumbled on this powerful impulse which is written into people, this urge to want to clearly differentiate themselves, declare their category.
I am definitely a cat person.
I'm a dog person.
Yeah, and the categories themselves were so clearly defined. It was like there, right below the surface, was this whole world of qualities associated with what it means to be a cat person or a dog person.
Dog people are chatty.
They like to talk to people on the street.
Cat person likes to stay at home. Maybe they don't want to go out as much.
Dog lovers are also like fun-loving and loyal.
Most people who are more attached to a cat, from my experience, who more only think about themselves.
So that was from Invisibilia, a new podcast produced by NPR News. Matt Staub, you know, that sounds really like a public radio show. It's very slickly produced. There's music. There's voices coming in and out. It's highly edited. Is that the kind of podcast you tend to prefer, or would you like a more old school sort of sound?
You know, I think it depends. In the same way that you may consume different types of TV shows or radio programs, depending on your mood and taste, I listen to some straight up what they call Gabfest formats, where it's just three people sitting in a room. That's more of the style of our podcast. And then these really great production values that are evocative of the experience like that are really magical too. And it depends on when I want to be transported to that scene or whether I just want to be educated.
Jesse Thorne, you obviously produce a variety of podcasts. Can you tell us something you're listening to maybe that sounds a little different than that?
Yeah, sure. You know, I really love this show called The Best Show. It's hosted by a comedy writer and longtime radio host named Tom Sharpling. And it ran for about 10 years on WFMU, which is a legendary freeform public radio station in Jersey City, New Jersey. And about a year ago, Tom took it off the air there, where it would raise, I mean, you know, once a year in the pledge drive, they'd raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for WFMU.
Wow.
Tom took it off the air there and has recently restarted it as an internet broadcast, and he broadcasts live, taking callers on the internet, and then podcasts the result. And what I love about it is that it's sort of both a celebration of and deconstruction of the traditional call-in radio format. Tom is someone that inspires incredible loyalty and emotional connection. He's a really, really funny guy. But like a big part of the show, it seems to be like trying to tell whether Tom is actually sincere about whatever it is he happens to be talking about. There's this great David Foster Wallace essay about talk radio that I don't know if you've ever read, where he talks about the essential element of especially call-in talk radio being achieving the kind of emotional hotness that gets people to call in and gets people pumped, no matter how it has to be done. And Tom can do that about anything. I mean, he recently dedicated probably half an hour of the show to how upset he was with Ringo Starr for insisting that he be elected to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a solo artist. And he threw him into what Tom calls the hate pit. there's also these segments that feature John Worster, who's a relatively famous rock and roll drummer. He plays with Superchunk and the Mountain Goats and Bob Mould. And John calls in character, and Tom doesn't acknowledge that it's John calling in character. And they've created this kind of this fictional town called Newbridge, New Jersey, that has this complicated backstory and all of these dozens of characters that John does. And so every episode features this often 30, 40, 45 minute call, a conversation between John and Tom that feeds into this mythology and is it's sort of a new kind of comedy. It's this sort of slow burn that builds not just over that 45 minutes, but over the weeks of accruing listening to the show.
Well, let's take a listen to an episode of The Best Show. This one features a caller named Darren, who is calling in for his time in the limelight.
For people who don't know, this is Darren Ploppleton, who I work with at my day job over at Consolidated Cardboard.
Ow! Oh! Oh!
What's wrong?
I'm sorry. Hang on. I just stubbed my toe on one of those pebbled garbage cans. Oof, man.
Oof. Oh, that hurts.
I mean, I know those things help put this town on the map, but, man, when you bang your toe on one of those, it really hurts.
Mm-hmm.
It's like banging your foot against a shark's back upper molar like Rob Schneider did in Jaws. Ugh.
Roy Scheider was in Jaws. Not
yeah,
Rob.
The guy who said this boat needs to be way bigger.
That I think you're even getting a different guy mixed up here. That would, but you think you're all over the map here with that one.
I don't think
there.
I am. Who do you think I'm doing?
Rob, you said Rob Schneider.
Yeah.
Rob Schneider was not in Jaws.
What was he in?
He was in The Animal and Deuce Bigelow.
Looks like you need to go back to rock school. I think you're thinking of Eric Burdon.
No, he was in The Animals.
Yeah.
Eric Burdon.
I know.
Was in a band.
Yes, I just took you to school.
Well, The Animal was a movie.
It was?
Yeah.
I don't get it. I don't like it. I don't get it. I don't want it.
Wow, you really, whatever it is, you are
pretty adamant, right?
It is not your thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that's the slow burn that Jesse Thorne was telling us about of comedy in the podcast The Best Show. Jesse, is that a pretty typical clip?
It is. You know, it's funny to think of like what I would make of that were I not a Best Show listener.
I think maybe like some of our listeners are wondering that same thing.
5 minutes out of 30 of a conversation between John Werster and Tom Sharpling. You know, parts of the show are a more traditional show, but there's this amazing box set that just came out from Numero Group, which is a pretty spectacular reissue group that usually does like classic soul records and stuff like that. They're sort of a new Rhino Records. Of some of the best calls. It all started.
But these are fictional calls, like
these
that
are
one.
Fictional calls. John called in many years ago as a guy who had written a book called Rock, Rot, and Rule, which categorized all music acts in the history of popular music as either rocking, rotting, or ruling. And they took calls for an hour, and it became a sort of tape trading phenomenon, especially among touring indie rock bands. And that sort of gave birth to this incredible world. One of the elements of the world, by the way, is that Newbridge, New Jersey, is the world's capital of those pebbled public garbage cans.
And I'm glad to know that. See, this it's an educational program. So, Brianna O'Higgins, you also, as a prodigious listener to podcasts, have a few all-time favorites, right?
I found out, too, before the show that Matt and I share this. I don't know if it's your favorite, but definitely one we listen to, which is Stuff You Should Know. And it comes from a network that does not predate, to my knowledge, Jesse Thorne's network. But it definitely predate Alex Bloomberg's network.
Yes. The name of that network is?
I think it's the Stuff Network now. And they've, you know, I think they originally were Discovery Channel owned. I don't think they're owned by Discovery Channel anymore. But I don't know the inner workings.
Okay.
Big media, though.
Yeah.
That's true. You're absolutely correct. It used to be owned by Discovery, but Discovery sold them about a year and a half ago.
Okay. And it hasn't changed. I mean, not that I've really noticed. The Stuff You Should Know is hosted by these two guys. What's their names? Josh Clark.
And Chuck.
Chuck Bryant.
Chuck Bryant. You got it. And this is like more of a gab. I don't know if you would say call it a gab fest, or it's only two of
them. It's a smart gab fest, though.
Yeah, and they just have a really good rapport. They just feed off each other. Josh is kind of the lead, and it's a back and forth, and it's, you know, stuff you should know, how this works, how that works, how rainbows work, how poison ivy works, how anything you can. And they talk for 45 minutes about it.
All right, well, we're going to listen not for 45 minutes, but for a couple of minutes about the history of ice cream.
And the other cool thing, too, was during World War II, apparently, it was the armed forces were all trying to outstep one another in providing ice cream to the troops in new and exciting ways, because it was such a morale booster, of course, to get ice cream when you're at war.
Right.
You know, a little taste of home. And I think that was it the Navy that had the ship?
Yeah, the world's first floating ice cream parlor.
That's awesome. In the Western Pacific.
Well, even before that, in World War I, ice cream was deemed an essential food. And so ice cream manufacturers got rations of sugar so they could keep making ice cream during the war, even though everything else was being rationed.
Yeah, and Ed points out that during the Depression, everything kind of slowed down that was a non-essential, including ice cream. But it never went away. And through the years, it's pretty much gained in popularity. I think in the 70s is when you started to see a little more health-conscious efforts,
yeah,
like the frozen yogurts and the like.
Froyo.
Froyo.
Right.
Emily loves the Froyo.
It's good stuff.
Like the new stuff that's really like from the Greek yogurt, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's tangy.
Changes everything.
Not like, I think this can't be yogurt growing up. Was that even yogurt? That was just like soft serve ice cream, wasn't it?
That was the podcast Stuff You Should Know, a mix of educational content with just a couple guys talking. Matt Staub, you this is one of your favorites as well. I guess I'm wondering, you could read the entire contents of this podcast. You could learn everything the same about how ice cream is made in probably about four paragraphs and 90 seconds instead of listening to a 45-minute podcast. So why do you listen?
So it's interesting. I've actually met Josh and Chuck before, and I felt it was a bizarre
Brianna
experience.
Brianna is starstruck that you've actually spoken.
I have a picture, but it was a bizarre experience because I felt like I really knew them, like we were old pals, and that's the experience of listening to the show. It's like sitting in a coffee shop or in the living room and chatting about these crazy topics that run the gamut of all kinds of academic pursuits, and it's just really comfortable. It's that transformative thing that just you escape to it and you sit around and talk about ice cream with your pals Josh and Chuck for 45 minutes.
Well, we've got a few more minutes before we have to stop talking about ice cream and other topics, so we'll come back. We do want to invite you as our listeners to share some of your favorite podcasts. What are you listening to these days? 816-235-2888 is how you can let us know about the specifics. 235-2888. Stick around for more Central Standard. Central Standard is back. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We're talking about podcasts today with our audiophiles, who today are Jesse Thorne, who makes a lot of podcasts through Maximum Fun, Matt Staub, who produces the local Is There, There, There podcast, and Brianna O'Higgins, who consumes and distributes digital content on your behalf here at KCUR. You can join us, too, by calling 816-235-2888. 235-2888. Jesse Thorne, tell us something else that you are listening to of late. I noticed that one of the programs you suggested was a BBC program, actually, that's now as a podcast, The History of the World. What's that about?
Yeah, it's called The History of the World in 100 Objects. It is a collaboration between the BBC and the British Museum. And it is one of the curators of the British Museum presents it, and he is the most hilariously curator of the British Museum-y dude you will ever hear.
Everything
in your
he
earphones.
Should be.
But what the show is, its conceit essentially is that it tells the history of the world through 100 episodes, each of which is devoted to one object in the collection of the British Museum. And the British, having traveled the world plundering its treasures for a few hundred years, up until about 50 years ago, have a really great collection of stuff with which to tell the story of the world. And I love stuff. It's a really wonderful lens through which to look at world history. And it's also just a very charming and entertaining show. And I'm not a super huge BBC guy, but I love this show. And I've listened to all 100 episodes, and I'm actually thinking about starting back over at the beginning.
Wow. Well, we won't make everyone start from the beginning, but here's a little taste of the history of the world in 100 objects.
If in seven houses there are seven cats, if each cat catches seven mice, if each mouse had eaten seven ears of corn, and each ear of corn, if sown, would have produced 7 gallons of grain, how many things are mentioned in total? While you're counting, I'll tell you that this is just one of nearly 100 similar problems, all equally complicated, all carefully written out with the answers and showing the workings in best schoolbook manner, that are recorded in the Rhind Mathematical Papyrus, the most famous mathematical papyrus to have survived from ancient Egypt, and the major source for our understanding of how the Egyptians thought about numbers.
Some of the maths is very, very practical. Other problems are more abstract.
I think we see the beginnings of a realisation that mathematics is not about specific numbers, about specific problems, that you can extract from it general procedures, general rules that you can follow in lots of cases.
A history of the world in 100 objects.
Thank you.
the Rhind Mathematical Papyrus. Around 3,500 years old, discovered in Thebes, Egypt.
It owes its name to an Aberdeen lawyer, Alexander Rhind, who in the 1850s took to wintering in Egypt because the dry heat helped his tuberculosis. There, in Luxor, he bought this papyrus, which turns out to be the largest mathematical text we know, not just from Egypt, but from anywhere in the ancient world.
That's the BBC's History of the World in 100 Objects podcast, recommended to you by Jesse Thorne, who is the owner and proprietor of Maximum Fun, a podcasting company. Jesse, history, comedy, beauty all sort of wound together in that.
Yeah, and just the comedy largely comes from the fact that you're listening to a guy who, it's possible, has a more ridiculous voice than Oliver Sacks. I mean, just the most absurdly fusty, but really lovely narration in that show. Yeah, I mean, it's just a really fascinating conceit. And I, you know, as a podcast producer, I've come to really believe in having a show with a purpose behind it. And a purpose behind it that you can express to someone in a couple of sentences. And that's one of the best premises for a podcast that I've ever heard. And it's exceptionally well executed.
Well, Matt Staub, another of the ones that you recommended, actually meets that historical need, right?
Yeah, it's called Backstory. It comes from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. And the interesting approach to it is they take really big social ideas like the history of trash or the history of women in work or advertising in America. And they look at it from three historians, one focusing on 18th, one focusing on 19th, and one on 20th century. So you kind of see that evolution and the way we've thought about these issues differently over time. It's really kind of a fascinating approach.
So we're going to hear a clip about the Gettysburg Address from the podcast Backstory.
In the summer of 1863, the small town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, rotted.
In many instances, arms and legs and sometimes heads protrude.
This is a letter from Gettysburg Judge David Wills to the state's governor about the fetid corpses that lined the streets.
And my attention has been directed to several places where the hogs were actually rooting out the bodies and devouring them.
The Civil War battle that had raged in July had left some 5,000 dead and the tiny town uprooted. And historian Harold Holzer says it was Will's job to put things back together again.
David Will's main purpose, after he gets the dead temporarily buried and off the ground, is to create a final resting place, as Lincoln would put it, that would do honor to the unidentified fallen.
But Wills also knew there would be an even more difficult job, to give people something to remember Gettysburg by other than death and destruction.
What he came up with was this, a high-profile event to dedicate the new cemetery there. He'd gather notables from around the country in Gettysburg to memorialize the cemetery.
It was a brilliant PR conceit to have a massive event, if for no other reason, that the war hadn't ended at Gettysburg. There was a great feeling that this was an event that would not only do honor to the fallen, but would create a precedent for how properly to honor Union casualties.
At that time, the centerpiece of an event like this would be a speech. And so who would he invite to give this address at Gettysburg? To say the words that would echo for decades to come? Well, the choice was clear. There was only one person who came to mind, and that was Edward Everett.
Standing beneath this serene sky, overlooking these broad fields, now reposing from the labors of the waning year.
If you were looking for one person who would draw crowds and draw attention and be up to the demands of this great occasion, it was Edward Everett of Massachusetts, who was, as Lincoln put it, probably more famous for being famous than anybody in the country.
I guess that makes him sort of the Paris Hilton of his day. That was the podcast Backstory, explaining that Abraham Lincoln was not, in fact, the first choice to deliver an address in Gettysburg. Matt Staub, what else appeals to you about a podcast like Backstory?
I think it's just the way they deconstruct everything. They look at it over so many different distinct perspectives and really give you a rounded view of something you would never have occasion to think so much about otherwise.
Brianna O'Higgins, you spend a lot of your time now trying to think of how things are going to sound, especially things that maybe were designed for radio in the different packaging of podcasting or something that someone's going to download. What stands out to you as the most important quality in this kind of programming?
Oof, well, we've just recently launched a podcast called State House Blend, and we had to think about – so I'm used to thinking about like a host lead or making sure that's online because that gives a crucial piece of context to a radio story. But I think the intro is really important, something that's distinctive. We need music. We need something we say every time because you have to introduce that concept in every program, assuming this is the first program that person has heard, even if it's your 25th episode. So that's something you definitely have to think about.
Well, I'm afraid that is all the time we have for today's show. We've been joined today by the audiophiles, Matt Staub, who produces the local podcast Is There There There, KCUR's Brianna O'Higgins, our digital content editor, and Jesse Thorne, who runs the operation called Maximum Fun, produces and hosts many podcasts. Thanks to all of you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And we should note that you can listen to this conversation or subscribe to our podcast, the Central Standard Podcast, at kcur.org/Central Standard. You can also go on iTunes and search for Central Standard. We'll have the program up later today. Tomorrow, join us with the Folk Alliance Conference getting underway in Kansas City. We'll ask, what is folk? That's tomorrow at 10 here on Central Standard, which is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. We get lots of help from Patrick Quick and Daniel Booth. I'm Brian Ellison. Happy Fat Tuesday, everyone. And stick around. Up to Date is next.